Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. So how'd you sleep last night? Were you snoring away as soon as your head hit the pillow? Maybe you don't know it, but your bed partner certainly would. The thing is, snoring's not just disruptive to others. It can indicate a condition called obstructive sleep apnea, which stops breathing momentarily as many as 30 times a minute. Time was when the options for the 15 million Americans or so who suffer from sleep apnea were pretty bleak. They could have expensive surgery to remove the uvula or excessive tissue from the throat or nasal passages, or they could don an awkward mask, hooked up to a noisy oxygen tank. But the American College of Physicians recently released new sleep apnea guidelines based on a study with some surprising results. Here to tell us more is Dr. Safwan Bader. He's president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and he joins us by phone from Detroit. Welcome, Dr. Bader.
Thank you.
Who is typically affected by sleep apnea?
Well, we used to think in the old days that only overweight individuals are affected, but now we know that everyone could be affected by sleep apnea. Being overweight is a risk, increases the risk of sleep apnea, but really it's a disease that could affect people from childhood into late adulthood. We say this is dusk to dawn. Anyone could be affected. Now, who is most likely to be affected? Well, anyone who is overweight, anyone who snores, anyone who has high blood pressure. So if a patient has high blood pressure, that's about one-third of them have sleep apnea. If somebody has type 2 diabetes, that's about 4 out of 5 are likely to have sleep apnea. This is a substantial number of individuals who have the disease. So I think this is a major public health problem that could affect any one of us.
Well, because the number of people with diabetes is increasing.
Right. And yeah. So this is where it links to obesity as well. So obesity is a risk factor, no doubt about it. But somebody who has a small upper airway, I'm talking about the area of the throat, if that area is small and crowded to begin with, and then somebody becomes overweight, all of these things increase the risk. So what I tell my patients that anyone is at risk. So if somebody snores loudly, wakes up with a headache, develop episodes of choking or gasping while they sleep, or sleepy during the day, especially if driving or boring tasks, or waking up with dry mouth, all of these things could be signs and symptoms that sleep apnea is a clinical consideration.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Safwan Bader. He is the president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and we're talking about sleep apnea. So why is it such a problem that you stop breathing for a second?
Well,
it doesn't. It's not. Is it killing people?
Well, that's a great question. And that may be one of the issues that it took a while to be able to show the evidence for this. While it may not be killing people momentarily, but it is gradually eroding their health and contributing to increased mortality. What happens when you're not breathing is that your oxygen level, there is no oxygen going in. You're unable to get oxygen in. You're unable to clear the carbon dioxide. And then your brain gets the sensation that, hey, you're not breathing. So you develop what we call a brief arousal from sleep. So the sleep is fragmented. So the person wakes up in the morning tired and exhausted as if they haven't slept. So as a result, this condition has major, major consequences. So when epidemiologic studies that looked over a decade or longer found that there is about 3 to 4 times increased mortality compared to the rest of the population. So this is actually especially from cardiac causes. Also, patients with sleep apnea are about 6 to 7 times more likely to be involved in a motor vehicle accident. So this is, you could be killing yourself and you also could be harming others at the same time.
If you have a question or comment for our guest, Dr. Bader, president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what are the new guidelines or recommendations that that some people are finding surprising?
The new guidelines from the American College of Physicians are to me, they're not very surprising. They're simply synthesis of the available literature. And for the most part, they're actually very congruent with the guidelines that have been issued by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. The three main pillars of this is, one is management of obesity. And rightly so, the American College of Physicians is saying that obviously we need to decrease weight. People need to lose weight. Now, I want to make sure that the audience do not, our listeners do not understand this as saying weight loss alone is sufficient, because there is evidence that it is not sufficient alone. It's good all over, but it is not sufficient alone as a treatment. The second recommendation is the device that's called nasal CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure. And I have a minor correction to make. It's no longer an awkward mask, actually.
I know.
Okay? And it is not pumping oxygen.
Right.
The way I explain it to my patients is, sleep apnea happened because the collapsible part, the part of the breathing passage in the neck, it becomes like a flat tire. And how do you inflate a tire? You pump air under pressure. So it's really a mask that's giving a steady stream, a steady flow of air. It's regular room air and pressurizes the airway, keeping it open. So it's no longer awkward. Now, this is a major progress over the past 20 years.
Uh-huh.
These devices now are much quieter. It's a window fan. Actually, bed partners prefer CPAP to the snoring because this is a soft, faint window fan type sound as opposed to the freight train that snoring could be. And the other thing with it is now they also have humidification, which makes it more comfortable. So this is the second recommendation of the American College of Physicians. The third recommendation, there are patients who may not be able to tolerate the continuous positive airway pressure or the CPAP machine. And in certain individuals, oral appliances which advance the jaw could open up the space and improve breathing.
Kind of like a bite guard?
It is kind of like bite guard, but imagine somebody trying to kind of trying to look like Jay Leno, moving their chin forward.
Okay.
it's that kind of thing,
all
but
right.
Only during sleep, and that opens up the airway, creates more of a space. Now, this would probably be more effective in those who have a milder disease, not the ones with a very severe disease, who aren't very overweight. The anatomy of the jaw is kind of the driver. But regardless, we'd like to test these people afterwards to make sure that we've actually corrected the sleep apnea. So really, these things are not different. They're just a different way of presenting the information. And we hope that by this reaching the whole community of physicians, especially primary care physicians, that we can increase awareness of sleep apnea and its risks.
I mentioned at the beginning when I described obstructive sleep apnea, I said it stops breathing momentarily as many as 30 times a minute. What's the typical amount of time per minute? I mean, what is that the okay. outside number, or is that a lower number?
Well, actually, I have another correction. You
okay.
got your minutes and hour kind of mixed up.
Well,
because in a minute, usually you have about typically. We don't breathe 30 times per minute. I mean, it's per hour. It's per hour of sleep.
Okay.
So usually an average person breathes about 12 to 14 per minute.
Okay.
That's an hour average breathing rate.
And so then they stop.
So when they stop about 10 seconds of a pause, that we call that an apnea, which
okay.
means cessation of breathing. So we've had anywhere from 5 to 100 per hour. We've had patients who basically they are, when they fall asleep, they stop breathing, they wake up momentarily for 10, 20, 30 seconds, and then they fall back to sleep, and then they stop breathing again.
And
so,
is there a little is a little apnea okay, or is it is the idea that you got no apnea, no disruption?
Well, there is probably a threshold in every individual as to when many of us, as we're falling asleep, we may go through a period of kind of instability for a few minutes where we may have a few apneas. These particularly aren't that significant. But the starting point here is the person's symptoms. So if somebody's starting with snoring, sleep fragmentation, sleepiness during the day, especially if they have other conditions, we look at it very, very carefully. Now, the standard number is about 5 per hour. So that's actually how the diagnosis is made. If somebody has more than 5 events per hour and is symptomatic, we call that now obstructive sleep apnea syndrome.
And the other symptom of coughing, choking, can you talk about that a little bit more? That's not as familiar.
Well, it's not necessarily coughing. It's more of a choking sensation.
Okay.
Because if somebody is not breathing, they close their upper airway. They're basically choking on their own airway.
Okay.
And then they wake up momentarily. When they wake up, they have this loud gasp. So to their pet partner, it's a loud gasp. And they wake up with a sensation of choking. Now, it's not a very common one, but when it's there, it's obviously a very strong indication that this person has sleep apnea syndrome.
When it comes to sleep disorders, how much does sleep apnea represent?
Well, there are probably about 15 to 18 million Americans with sleep apnea.
Okay.
And I think the numbers are unfortunately increasing because of the obesity epidemic.
Okay.
So many of the epidemiologic data were from the last century. And if you look at all the epidemiologic studies on the prevalence of obesity, it has increased. So I think 15 to 18 million is perhaps even a conservative estimate, in my view. However, the vast majority of those are not diagnosed. So that's why we need to increase the awareness of the condition.
What are the sleep clinics like? If someone goes to one of those places, what happens to them? What do you do?
Okay, well, because now sleep medicine has become a complete specialty that covers the whole continuum of sleep disorders,
mm-hmm.
and probably about 40 million to 70 million Americans have chronic sleep disorders, what we recommend is that patients seek the advice and seek an evaluation by a sleep specialist. And now there's even board certification. So it's a board certified sleep specialist who's affiliated with an accredited sleep center. Because sleep is not just about doing a quick diagnosis of with a single device or a single test. Accredited centers have the full continuum of services that are needed. And the accreditation is by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine for obviously certain quality and performance criteria. And in these, if somebody needs a sleep study, is actually staying overnight in a sleep lab, fully monitored the whole night. And that is one way of the diagnosis. Then there is another way of the diagnosis in those who have high likelihood of having sleep apnea, but do not have other comorbid conditions that make the study difficult to interpret. We can actually do studies at home for some of these folks. So you can even do what we call portable or unattended or limited, different terminology at home, or a fully monitored attended sleep study in a sleep laboratory. I would emphasize that really both need to be evaluated and read by a specialist, by somebody who's an expert who has the training and the expertise to manage these kind of conditions.
When you do one of those overnight, whether it's at home or at the sleep center, do you just sleep the way you ordinarily would? Say you use drugs to help
you
sleep.
No, actually, it has to be natural sleep any medication could degrade the quality of sleep.
Okay. All right. Dr. Bader, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
It's Dr. Safwan Bader. He is president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Coming up, we're going to talk about acupuncture and how it may help some people at this time of extreme allergic response. We'll be right back. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Something's living on my skin. Doctor, please,
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Where do they find these songs? Usually we think of autumn as nature's last hurrah. Squirrels get fat eating and storing nuts. Leaves show their true colors, then become yard waste. And not to be outdone, the ragweed blows all over creation like confetti before it settles in your sinuses. For allergy sufferers, this can take the fun out of the annual trip to the pumpkin patch. And many turn to over-the-counter antihistamines or prescriptions to arrest that constant sneezing and itchy eyes. Acupuncture is one alternative. Joining us now to talk about that is Sarah Calabro. She's founding editor of Accutake.com. It's an acupuncture information website, and she joins us from her home in Oregon. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Most people know how acupuncture involves being stuck with needles, but what does being stuck do kind of generally? What are we doing with that?
Sure. So acupuncture is one branch of Chinese medicine. It falls within that system of medicine. There are other branches such as herbal medicine, Tuinam, massage, body work, and those kinds of things. But acupuncture is, you know, typically the modality that we know the best here in the West. And so acupuncture is the use of very fine, almost as fine as a hair, single-use disposable needles that are placed at various acupuncture points throughout the body. So what we're trying to do with that is balance out the energies is probably the closest word that we can use here for people to understand. Balance out the energies in the 14 main meridians in the body. So there are various meridians in the body, and those meridians have various functions. And the goal is to keep those things balanced so that you can function optimally.
Chinese medicine takes a pretty different approach to health from Western medicine. How would Chinese medicine view what we call fall allergies? How is it perceived in the context of acupuncture and Chinese medicine?
Right. So that's a great question, because, you know, when we say acupuncture works for allergies, we're saying allergies. But as you're pointing out, you know, from an acupuncture perspective, the allergies is just a symptom of an underlying imbalance. And what is unique about acupuncture in comparison to Western medicine is that that imbalance can be different for everyone. So, you know, you might get a different treatment for allergies than I would. But there are some patterns that tend to show up more than others in the fall when it comes to allergies. So, you know, these are terms that might not make sense to people, but their word wei qi. So wei qi in Chinese medicine and acupuncture is kind of our defensive energy. It's thought of as the first layer that pathogens would face when they're coming into our bodies. So when people suffer from allergies and colds and immune deficiencies, things like that, it's said that the wei qi is deficient. So what the acupuncture treatment will be doing would be boosting that wei qi. So that's that's one example of an imbalance.
And how, when you approach an allergy symptom, how does acupuncture relieve symptoms like sneezing and itchy eyes? So if you shoot for the wei qi first, kind of overall, and then you can get more specific if you have to?
Okay. So the wei qi, and that's a good clarification, because so the approach of going after the wei qi, that's almost once you have sort of a full blown allergy attack, it's almost like you're too late with the wei qi in some ways. I mean, you still want to address that, because that's going to then be preventive so that someone doesn't keep getting these symptoms of allergies throughout the season. Mm-hmm. But while acupuncture is working on the underlying imbalance, it does also have it can provide symptomatic relief. So, and allergies is one of the things that actually you can actually see results with a patient right on the table, which is, it can be kind of striking. So, you know, by placing these needles, some of them go in the face, which some people are not terribly thrilled about, but it actually doesn't hurt. But, you know, so you place these needles around the sinus area, so around the nose, kind of below the eyes, and if you suffer from sinus or allergy headaches, you know, possibly in the in your forehead also, and it creates a response that essentially causes you know, you to drain out of your nose, and really, you know, people right on the table can sort of have this response of the mucus actually draining out of their sinuses.
So there's a box of tissue nearby.
Excuse me?
And there's a box of tissue nearby then.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, especially if it's a face down treatment, you need to make sure that someone has some tissues so that they can really start dripping. So, yeah.
For someone who's never been to an acupuncturist before, I know there's lots of different venues, but these days, what generally can they expect from a reputable acupuncturist, Sarah?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I would say they're, you know, as you pointed out, the acupuncturists are so different that they really vary from practitioner to practitioner. But very broadly speaking, you know, it could be divided into there's private acupuncture and there's community acupuncture. So community acupuncture is, as you might expect, it's a community setting where you're treated with other people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
These clinics tend to be more affordable. You're often treated seated in a chair rather than laying down in a table. You remove less clothing. You know, most of the treatments are just below the elbows and knees. So that's one style of treatment, which, by the way, can be great for seasonal type stuff where more frequent treatments are needed because they're more affordable. And then the other side is private acupuncture, which fortunately more and more insurance companies are starting to cover. And a typical private acupuncture experience is, you know, again, varies, but can be similar to going to a doctor. You know, you go in and there would be a receptionist or something, and you would check in, and then the acupuncturist would see you. The difference there is going to be that the intake process with an acupuncturist will typically be significantly longer than you might spend with a primary care doctor or other Western physician. Kind of the bread and butter of private acupuncture is really sitting down with the patient and really understanding what's going on with them. One of the main you know, a premise of acupuncture is that everyone is different. So again, your allergies are different than mine,
mm-hmm.
and to understand that, you need to really talk to someone and find out what's going on.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about acupuncture and specifically, you know, using acupuncture to treat allergies. My guest is Sarah Calabro. She is the founding editor of AccuTake. It's an acupuncture information website. If you have any questions or comments for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do you find it? Well, you mentioned more and more insurance companies are covering acupuncture. It's true. And what about Affordable Care Act? Is acupuncture included in that?
You know, that's a good question, and I think that's sort of to be determined and will vary by insurance company from what I understand.
Okay.
I couldn't.
Just like it does now. It just depends on which one you buy.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Okay. Do the needles hurt?
Good question, right? The burning question that everyone wants to know. I don't like to say no, absolutely not. They don't feel like you think they're going to feel. Everyone experiences pain differently, and I've kind of tried to move away from just making a blanket statement that acupuncture doesn't hurt. So
right.
For some people, it can be, you might experience an unpleasant sensation. It does not feel like getting a needle, you know, when you go to get blood drawn or something like that. It's not in any way resembling that experience. It can feel sometimes like a little mosquito bite. It also can feel not sharp at all, but once the needle is in, sometimes people feel sort of a heaviness or achy kind of feeling at the needle site.
Uh-huh.
Most people truly report that the experience is pleasant overall, and some patients actually really enjoy, you know, kind of getting that acupuncture feeling.
Uh-huh.
You know, it sort of gives you that feeling that this is working, this is I'm feeling this. But you know, everyone needs to take it at their own level. And another thing to keep in mind when looking for a practitioner is that, again, acupuncturists are very different, and some use different size needles. Different styles of acupuncture tend to use different gauge needles. Japanese acupuncture, as one example, typically uses very thin needles.
How deep do they go, and how do they stand up without, I mean, how do you keep them from flopping over? How does that work?
Weird, right? I know. Yeah. I mean, it actually just works.
Especially in your forehead.
It's a good point. I mean, you know, it's kind of surprising, but they do stay in. I mean, again, there are different styles, and some acupuncturists intentionally keep the needles very shallow, and they can flop a little bit and still be in there. Others, you know, in bigger muscles in the body, you know, if you're getting acupuncture in your leg or in some of the thicker muscles in your back, they can go quite deep, and you know, you might not even feel it, but there's more tissue there to work with.
Okay, let's see. Patrick in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome, Patrick.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
But I got a question about acupuncture. How effective is it, if it is at all, on habits, you know, addictions like smoking, drinking, drugs?
Sugar.
Sugar, okay. Yeah, I'll take it.
Oops, okay. So, thank you, Patrick. Sarah?
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. That's a great question. Acupuncture for addiction is very popular, as Patrick and other people might know. The response rates are variable. I mean, I've seen great results with it. There is a specific protocol for one great thing about acupuncture for addiction is that it's often offered at a very low cost. There's a protocol specifically for addiction called the NADA protocol. The organization is called NADA stands for National Association of Detox Acupuncture. I believe that's what NADA stands for. And it's a protocol, and it's just 5 acupuncture points in the ear. So you often are sitting in a chair. No, you don't have to take any of your clothes off. It's a very quick treatment. Many, even private acupuncturists will offer this at a low cost. You know, I don't know. It depends on region. But, you know, for $20 or something, you can get a NADA treatment. And NADA is an example of acupuncture really kind of making a lot of strides in the Western medical community. Many hospitals, even Western hospitals, have programs and acupuncturists working in their hospitals doing the NADA protocol.
All right. If you're not really into the needles, and some people just have a phobia about needles, as you well know, mm-hmm. I'm sure, are there other treatments? We hear about acupressure and that sort of thing. Are there other treatments that don't involve the needle but have the same philosophy behind them?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I can't overstate the benefits of acupressure. I mean, if you end up on your website directing people to that article that we talked about earlier about allergies, especially for allergies, because there's something that, you know, you'll kind of get inflamed and then you'll be fine the next hour. You know, so just being able to do these things yourself is really powerful. So acupressure is amazing. I can't overstate that. Other things, as I mentioned earlier, other branches of Chinese medicine include herbal medicine, Tui Na, which is a form of body work or massage, that can be great. And it's sort of working from a similar philosophy of going after the meridians. Qigong is sort of it's a movement therapy that's, again, great because it's self-care and it's something that you can do on your own at home. And another branch of Chinese medicine is of course, dietary theory, which is it's a whole branch that we don't have time to get into, but basically eating seasonally and according to your constitution. And that's something that you could talk to an acupuncturist about as well.
But acupuncture at this point is the only thing that is covered by insurance, if anything.
Typically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Typically, acupuncture is the one that seems to have gotten the most traction there. Yeah.
Okay. Centina in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome, Centina. Hi, Centina.
Oh, yes. Okay. Hello.
Hi.
I was calling with a twofold question. First of all, can acupuncture help with depression? And also, how would one find a good practitioner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So depression, again, like allergies, you know, depression is what is the symptom we're calling that as Westerners, and that's how we think of it. Acupuncturists are not treating depression per se. You know, they're treating the underlying imbalance that is causing depression. And from an acupuncture perspective, several imbalances can cause depression symptoms. So the answer, you know, the simple answer is yes. The more kind of complicated answer is you would need to talk to an acupuncturist to find out what your underlying imbalance is. Some underlying imbalances are more responsive to acupuncture than others. I think that's probably the simplest way to say it. But certainly depression is something that many acupuncturists treat. Many acupuncturists specialize in it. That's actually raises the issue of kind of going into your next question of how to find an acupuncturist. While many acupuncturists are generalists, and in acupuncture school, you learn how to kind of, in theory, treat everything because, you know, again, you're working systemically. So in theory, you should be able to treat any symptom. However, many acupuncturists do over time start to specialize, you know, just by nature of they sort of get a reputation for seeing something or they have a personal interest in a specific condition. So things like depression, other emotional type things, often acupuncturists will specialize in those kinds of things. So that's something to inquire about. You know, you probably wouldn't want to go to someone who specializes in orthopedics or sports injuries if what your issue is depression. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just something to inquire about when you're trying to find an acupuncturist. In terms of how to find one, my website, AccuTake, has an affiliated acupuncturist directory, which I'd love if people went there. It's accutakedirectory.com. If your insurance covers acupuncture, the acupuncturist should be listed on the insurance website. And then really, you know, aside from that, Google and word of mouth are probably your best bet. And I would encourage you to, if you're Googling someone, word of mouth is great because you get sort of that built-in recommendation. But if you're Googling someone, call them, you know, call the acupuncturist and ask them, here's what I have going on. What, you know, what's your experience with this? And if they're put off by that, I'd say move on, mm-hmm. you know, move on to someone who's willing to answer that question.
Okay, Santina, thanks for the call. We have a quick email from Robert in Canton, I think, or Caton. Anyways, I suffer from periodic sinus headaches brought on by either the weather or drinking wine. Your guest mentioned acupuncture treatments doing a good job of draining sinuses. How long do treatments last?
That's a good question. I heard the drinking wine. It cut out a little bit. What else was bringing on?
Either the weather or drinking wine.
Right. So whether or drinking wine. regarding the drinking wine.
Too bad about that. But
I know. It is too bad. I mean, unfortunately, there are things. While acupuncture is fantastic, there are certain things that some people just can't drink red wine. You know, they just can't. And they can't eat certain things. And so you can do acupuncture all day long. But if someone has a sort of, you know, even if it's mild, a mild allergy to something, it's probably not going to mm-hmm. go away. So paying attention, you know, sort of holistically to what's going on with you is important. But how long do the treatments last? I mean, like I said, with sinus stuff, you can see results right on the table. It can be kind of remarkable. Anywhere from immediate results to some people don't feel anything for 3 days and then suddenly they're feeling clear. It really just depends. I know that's sort of a bit of a frustrating answer, but it's actually the truth. It just depends, and you kind of have to try it out and see.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were saying about depression, some people's underlying imbalance resolves quicker than others.
Yeah, it just depends. We do have a caller. I'm not going to get to him, but he asks the question of whether there's any scientific evidence for help with addiction. What do we know about that?
Yeah, this is an issue that it sounds like we don't have time to go into, I would really encourage people when it comes to scientific evidence, research on acupuncture, to do their own research and to think critically. Addiction is actually one of the areas, as I mentioned, because it has made so many inroads in Western medicine that there is a fair amount of research on. Just something to keep in mind, though, when reviewing acupuncture studies is that acupuncture was not designed to be studied under the our gold standard model of double-blind clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, the whole idea behind acupuncture is that everyone's different. And the whole idea behind one of the main ideas behind double-blind trials is that things are standardized. So it's difficult to study a modality that by nature is not meant to be standardized. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In the real world, you would not be treated with acupuncture the way you would be in a clinical trial. So just something to think about. It doesn't mean, you know, there are a lot of people that are working very hard, tirelessly and doing great work to study acupuncture. Those studies are important and valid, but just to think critically and to remember that when reading the headlines that you might see about acupuncture.
Okay, Sarah Calabro, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, Dan.
Sarah Calabro is founding editor of AccuTake. Is it accutake.com?
It's AccutakeHealth.com.
Sorry about that.
And no
thanks for joining us today. Coming up, I'm going to ask that question about Obamacare and acupuncture and several others. After the first day down, the second one up with the registries on board. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, continuing our ongoing series on the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, whatever you're into calling it. If you want to call it what the president calls it, it's Obamacare. The government may be shut down, but the healthcare exchanges are now open for business. And while Congress tries to settle its differences, millions of Americans can go online to healthcare.gov and start signing up to receive coverage, or at least to look at what coverage is being offered. That kicks in on January 1st of 2014. Sign up for Obamacare was off to a vigorous, if somewhat glitchy, start. Yesterday, the federal website crashed due to an overwhelming number of visitors. The president said over a million people visited the site before 7 a.m. Eastern time. But armed with a lot of patience and a little knowledge, the uninsured should slowly be able to navigate the system. And there were problems in Ohio with a shortage of so-called navigators, guides for people who want to sign up. That should be rectified in the next week or two, they say. Joining us now to review the basics is Kathleen Geminer, Project Director for Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage at UCAN Ohio. Welcome back to the show, Kathleen.
Good to be here, Ann.
If anyone has a question, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Kathleen, do reports of these early morning signups remind you of Black Friday sales at Walmart? I mean,
I hadn't actually thought about it in that way. You know, I was one of those people that was online before 6 a.m. yesterday morning, hoping to get a look at all the plans and unable to, like many other people. The data I saw this morning is something like 2.8 million people had gone to the federal site yesterday. In the state of New York, where they have their own exchange, more than 2 million people had gone online. So that was a huge number. And what I think this is showing is that there is an overwhelming interest in getting health coverage and finding coverage that's affordable and no longer excludes people because of a pre-existing medical condition.
I wonder how many people actually signed up yesterday. Do you think it was more a fishing expedition for a lot of people? They just wanted to check it out?
I think that my guess is that a lot of people did not sign up yesterday because they would have gone on perhaps just to check it out. And then with a waiting period, they may have just decided to shut it down and come back, you know, on another day. And in fact, we were doing some phone banking work yesterday, and we were advising the callers that they should come back in a few days, and that way they wouldn't have to wait so long. It makes sense. People have until December 15th to get enrolled, pay their premium for the first month, and actually have coverage on January 1 of 2014. And then they actually have an opportunity to enroll all the way up through March 31st of 2014.
Do we have any idea or how soon we'll know who is signing up, what the demographics are?
You know, Ann, I don't know the answer to that question. I think we've been looking to HHS as to what data they will be collecting and will be making available to people. I can tell you that from our phone bank work yesterday, we found a lot of people who were calling us were people who would qualify for the Medicaid expansion if the Medicaid expansion were to be passed.
But won't
and are caught in that coverage gap. And interestingly, from all over, I mean, we were getting calls from all over Central Ohio and very far to the east and the suburbs of Columbus, a lot of people that would fall into that category. We were getting a lot of calls from older adults who are on Medicare, first wanting assurance that they're all set and that they don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. And then
And that
asking,
is the case if you're already on Medicare, right?
That is the case. and then asking about their children. You know, I have a daughter, I have a son, they're uninsured, what do they need to do? So I thought that was interesting that so many older adult parents were keeping an eye out for their adult children and then, of course, their grandchildren.
Well, they say that that age group, that younger people, you know, from their teens into their late 20s, I guess, are the toughest ones to get insured now, before Obamacare, and because they don't think they're, well, they don't get sick as much and so forth. But
yeah, actually, it's interesting. There is that perception, certainly, that young people feel that way. But we also have seen data coming from a group called the Young Invincibles that adults, young adults who are polled will show that they actually do care about having coverage. And for a lot of them, it just hasn't been available. You know, if they don't have a parent who, on whose plan they can stay, or their parent doesn't have a plan that they can stay on, or if they're over the 26 and over, then sometimes they have several part-time jobs that just don't offer coverage.
I've been insured for a long time now, and when I have to pick my insurance, what kind I'm going to want, I still get stressed out, and I really don't understand, and I'm never feeling confident that I'm picking the right one. How about people who have never had insurance, or it's been very long since they've had it? How do they go into the registry and make heads or tails of it?
Well, you know, this is one of the reasons that it's good for people to go to healthcare.gov and before clicking apply now, go on to some other parts of the website that say getting ready, because Health and Human Services has put out some very good materials on what people need to do to get ready. Materials that will talk about what is a deductible, what is a copay, what is a premium. These are terms that many people who have never purchased insurance or been insured are not, you know, not really familiar with. They will also tell them how to go about looking at their budget, gathering the materials on their income that would be helpful to have at hand when they go online to apply. So I suggest people do that first.
Is it an easy economic or earnings income cutoff thing? I mean, can you just ask somebody how much money do you make, and you'll know whether they.
No, not really.
Okay.
It's not that simple. It is true that the cost of premiums has now been brought down to about four different factors. Age is still a factor in how much someone will pay for their premium, whether the person smokes or not. And then their household composition, the amount, number of people in the household, and where they live. Because believe it or not, there actually is some premium variation within the state of Ohio between 17 different cost regions. You know, you might not realize this, but it actually costs more for health care in Southeast Ohio than it does here. And Cleveland area, Southwest Ohio, these are all different cost areas. And so those four factors play a part in determining how much someone will pay. So you really can't just say, how much do you make? Here's how much you're likely to pay.
Dwayne and Orient, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I just have a question, and then I'll sit back and listen.
Okay.
I have about 10 family members that they have absolutely no extra money at all. What money they do make won't pay for anything. I pay a couple others rent and so on.
Okay.
So I just like to know what them people are going to do.
Okay.
Okay, well, some of them may qualify for the Medicaid expansion if it passes in Ohio. Let me just say a little bit about that. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was required that all the states expand Medicaid to people with incomes up to 138% of the poverty level, which for a single person would be around $16,000 a year, annual income. After the Supreme Court ruled on the Affordable Care Act, it said that this should actually, this Medicaid expansion needs to be at the option of the state. And so Ohio has not yet accepted it. But for many of your family members, if their income as a single person is below about $16,000 a year, they will be eligible. And we're waiting to see if the Ohio legislature will pass it. For people who have income of 100% of the poverty level or more, they can go shopping in the exchange and get a subsidy. So if your income is at about 100% of poverty, you would then be paying about 2% of your income toward your premium. So for a person who's just at poverty level, $11,000, that's going to come to about $200 a year or about $18 a month that they would have to pay toward a premium. Then as your income goes up, the percentage of income you're expected to pay also rises, going up to 4% when you get up to about 100, and I think it's around 138% of poverty, 6%, 8%, and it tops off at 9.5%.
Okay, Duane, I hope that helped. I think the best advice is to get online and check it out and
see
what it's
going to
cost.
Yes, people should go on and they put their income in, have their income information, and then the program will actually tell you what you're eligible for and what your expected premium is.
Does any of the coverage cover, what am I thinking of? Acupuncture. We were talking about it earlier, and someone asked that question.
Yeah.
The person I talked to said, well, she thought that some of the coverage did, depending on what level you chose to go with. And then we got a call from somebody who said it didn't.
Acupuncture is one of many complementary medicines, which is very valuable for many people. However, it is not included as one of the 10 essential health benefits that is required to be included. And so it's going to be up to the plan whether they feel that it's cost-effective for them to include it.
Okay. Does Ohio, like we talked about, Ohio opted not to set up its own health insurance marketplace.
That's right.
Exchange. What does this mean for Ohioans who want to sign up? So that means that when they're going to that website, which we'll have on our website at WOSU.org/all sides, when they go to that website, that's the federal website, right?
It is. It's they're going to healthcare, all one word, .gov, G-O-V. That's the federal website. It will ask them what state they are from. And when you click Ohio, you will then be into the Ohio federally facilitated marketplace.
Okay, and that's all set up. It's the navigator part of this is actual people. What was the holdup with that?
Oh, there have been several holdups with the navigators. The grants were announced on the 15th of August. That's a very short time for organizations to hire people, get them trained. There's a 20-hour online training that people must go through to be certified. And then the state of Ohio has added a layer onto that, an Ohio certification.
Which does what? What does that do?
Well, from Ohio's perspective, they feel it gives them more control and that they're able to watch the navigators more carefully to make sure that the information they're giving, et cetera, is correct. In other words, that the people that are hired, that they've seen something about them. They require a background check, so they're making sure at the Ohio level that people who have a criminal record aren't doing this.
Are other states doing that?
Yes, other states are doing it. I can't tell you how many. Mm-hmm. I know at least a dozen or more have done what Ohio has done.
Duane was talking about 10 of his family members don't have a spare dime at the end of every month. What happens if they don't sign up for something by January 1st?
Well, people who are not insured will pay a penalty. It'll be held out of their 2015. It's the 2014 tax refund that you would get in early 2015. For the first year, it's either $95 or 1% of your income, whichever is greater for the whole year. Mm-hmm. There's a 3-month grace period, so people can actually slip beyond January 1st without being penalized. Mm-hmm. If they want to avoid any penalty, they do need to be signed up, certainly by March 15th, in order to make sure that their coverage starts on April 1st. When people sign up and pay their premium after the 15th of the month, the coverage starts like the second month following. You know, so if it's like March 28th, it's going to be May 1st before you're actually covered.
And people, young people who are now under their parents' coverage, should they, will they stay on their parents' coverage?
Certainly.
Or does that, okay,
no,
they until can, they're 26?
Oh, yeah. No, that's that remains part of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
Wasn't like a stopgap thing.
No, that was okay. Not stopgap. Absolutely not.
But that gets them into the groove of being insured.
It sure does. It's been one of the most successful parts of the Affordable Care Act. 97,000 Ohio young people have benefited from it.
Well, Kathleen Gemeiner, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Okay, you're very welcome, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for listening today. Kathleen Gemeiner is the Project Director for Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage at UCAN Ohio. We'll have that website on our website at WOSU.org. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.